Welcome back, or, if it's your first time, welcome to this, my letter from the back, which is inspired by Alistair Cook's Radio 4 Letter from America. It's my endeavour to look back on the week of transport with a side order of law, so please ease yourself back into your favourite chair, get your breath back, and look forward to the weekend. If you can meet with triumph and disaster, and meet those two impostors just the same, is written on the back wall of the players' entrance at Wimbledon. Rudyard Kipling was inspired to write this line in his poem If, by the dramatic fortune and misfortunes he sustained during his life. It's not only a poem, it's a story unfolding before your very ears. If you have listened to one of our webinars during the past 17 weeks, you might think that my colleagues Jonathan Backhouse and Chloe West, better known to her audience as Penelope Pitstop, has turned a COVID disaster into a triumph of digital advice and storytelling. So let's go back to the beginning, and this letter will go back to the very beginning when story started, around the caveman's campfire, thousands of generations ago. If you can imagine a line of 400,000 women, each one a representative of each generation, one behind the other, then mother and daughter can be traced back for 7 million years. About 10,000 women back, we developed language which turned us from weak, middle-of-the-pack prey into the most powerful animal on Earth. Now, at the outset, we had to make do with non-fiction. If the leader of the pack said there was a predator in the forest, being able to trust his or her word conferred a survival advantage. But at some point, possibly about 5,000 women back, we started telling stories that might just have gone like this. A pretty but waif-like girl left the forbidding cave to harvest watercress from the meadow. When she happened across a monstrous saber-toothed tiger, but she had with her trusty flint axe, provided by her overprotective father, and she killed the beast with a single blow to the nose. She came home triumphant with the tiger skin, which became the height of fashion compared to the ubiquitous deer skins worn by the soon-to-be-extinct Neanderthals. Now, the purpose of this and the purpose of stories is to encourage and embolden the listener and make sure they're still alive in the morning as a result of primitive mutual cooperation. Stories could be about hunting bison, finding truffles, or keeping up with the Joneses, who consider hunter-gathering rather passé and had moved to subsistence farming in the suburbs. And the feedback from our webinars is that transport operators have been informed, entertained, and possibly even emboldened by a shared community of advice provided by Jonathan and his team. And just with this in mind, I'm taken back to December 2019, which seems a long time ago. But the great storyteller and my marketing hero, Rory Sutherland, identified the time it took for various technologies to be adopted by 50 million people. From its introduction, the telephone took 75 years to reach 50 million users. For the radio, it was 38 years. For television, it was 13 years. And for the World Wide Web, a mere 4 years. Online services were faster still. Facebook reached 50 million within 2 years. YouTube in 10 months. Twitter in 9 months. Pokemon Go and Pornhub reached this watermark in just 19 days. and for the benefit of those who profess not to know what I'm talking about, Pokemon Go was a 2016 format augmented reality game where you use your phone to catch animated monsters. Now, Rory tells us that video conferencing was long held back by the slow speeds of non-fibre broadband. And with a heavy dose of humility and a side order of irony, he tells us that just last year, 2019, he advised the founder of Zoom that all his invention needed was a global pandemic. So 2,000 years ago, our Rory might have been considered John the Baptist, a prophet, or at least a wise man urging his chums to pack frankincense to follow a star. So our resident stargazer explained last year that the problem with video conferencing was that when it was novel, it was rubbish, and when it was brilliant, just pre-COVID, it wasn't novel. But I confess that I love my iPhone so much that I place it in a glass cabinet every evening surrounded by sugar. But still, pre-COVID, I wouldn't FaceTime. I just didn't understand, appreciate, or like it. But technological progress owes more to the messy processes of Darwinian evolution than it does to conscious design. After all, it was Darwin that said, "It is not the strongest nor the most intelligent of the species that survives, but rather it is the one that is most adaptable to change." Now, clearly the clients of Backhouse Jones are intelligent and adaptable because they've taken to webinar advice to such an extent that we've had to start a new company called the Back Academy to deal with the demand for e-training. During lockdown, e-training replaced our lawyers herring around the country, and now the technology has made its way as an imposter into the way that we provide training, and I can only see triumph coming from this disaster. I will come to the reality of a client disaster that struck as I was typing this letter just a few moments ago. But my guru, Rory, advises that often a technology is invented for one purpose and sits around for ages before someone finds a better use for it. For example, air conditioning. It was originally invented to protect paper from excess humidity in a factory. It was only when the owners noticed that in summer, the workers chose to eat their lunch in the air-conditioned storage room that the inventor spotted the real human application. Movie theatres. Movie theatres were the first non-industrial customers of air conditioning, as moviegoers would crowd into cinemas to escape the summer heat. In the USA, that is. There's less of a need for it here in Lancashire. This explains why America still has, which is odd to us British people, the tradition of the summer blockbuster. No self-respecting British person would consider going to the pictures on a sunny afternoon. That said, I'm writing this letter from the back in the warm sunshine of Manchester, where I'm in a local lockdown. And this gives me time to watch the webinar as clients do, on screen. And I confess to feeling paternal pride at how Chloe has mastered the tech and the dexterity of my almost son, James Lomax, to field difficult questions. James has just become a father for the second time with his son, Teddy, which leads into the story of how James was found at Backhouse Jones on the steps in a reed basket with a note round his neck saying, "Please take me in." At least that's how it seems to the directors of BHJ, because he's been with us ever since he was just out of short pants at school. One of our valued clients messaged me during the webinar to say that my boy was doing well, as for many years she had laboured under the misunderstanding that James was my son. He does have good hair. Running with this reference to summer heat, I do feel a little like Windsor Davis as the Sergeant Major in It Ain't Half Hot Mum, who describes Gunnar Parkins as a lovely boy, as he thinks he might be his father. James is a lovely boy, and the webinar shows the Backhouse family at its pixel best. Now that said, Jonathan and Scott made a confession during the webinar that they were wearing shorts and had done in virtual court hearings. So the wearing of shorts brings to mind another writer of letters, infinitely better than mine, and another personal hero of mine, the late, great A.A. Gill, who wrote an agony column titled Uncle Dysfunctional in Gentleman's Quarterly magazine. And one of the letters involved A.A.'s view on shorts, and he said they should never be worn after 12. That's 12 years, not 12 o'clock. He advised that nobody aged 13 or over should be seen in trousers that finish above the ankle. It doesn't matter how good your legs are or if you're on a beach in Bermuda, where they invented the things. This is not about temperature. This is about dignity, and it's impossible to be taken seriously in shorts. No one has ever cared about anything said by a man in shorts. You can propose marriage naked or in handcuffs, but no one is going to agree to marry a man in shorts. You can't declare war in shorts or deliver eulogy in shorts. Shorts are silly, and men in shorts are silly, and about the worst thing a man can be is silly. For the record, neither Jonathan nor Scott did stand up in court or during the webinar, and neither are silly. But my interest in letters has unearthed a treasure trove of other letter writers. Jonathan has a reputation for Lancastrian straight talking, but recently published letters from the Texan Edward Mike Davis make Jonathan look like a shrinking violet. From the offices of a now defunct but at one time Houston-based oil company named Tiger Oil came a batch of curiously entertaining memos, all sent by the firm's irascible, tactless, yet undeniably amusing chief executive named Edward Tiger Mike Davis. Some examples to follow. In a memo dated 12th of January 1978 to all his employees, Tiger Mike wrote, "I swear, but since I am the owner of this company, that is my privilege, and this privilege is not to be interpreted as the same for any employee. This differentiates me from you, and I want to keep it that way. There will be absolutely no swearing by any employee, male or female." Or there is this one dated 13th of January 1978. "Do not speak to me when you see me. If I want to speak to you, I will do so. I want to save my throat. I don't want to ruin it by saying hello to all you sons of bitches." Say what you like, but Tiger Mike was actually a brilliant communicator, as his style combines the four things needed in all communication from a leader. The first is brevity. The memo forbidding employees to talk to him is a mere 42 words, and better still, 39 of these have only one syllable. The second quality is clarity. Even the most stupid, distracted employee could understand his messages. It would be impossible not to be. Thirdly, he sounds sincere. Everyone knows exactly where they stand. And fourthly, he picks an achievable goal and tells people how to get there. Now, communication is absolutely vital for lawyers, but not all lawyers are into brevity. In 1987, I first entered a law firm to do some work experience in my hometown of Wigan, and the firm was named Wilson, Bullough, Boardman and Knowles. As I recall, the senior partner, who then was in his late 70s and had served with distinction in the Second World War, was a gentleman of the town. And I was always interested in marketing, so I suggested to him that we shorten the firm's name to WBBK, as to me it sounded like a radio station from the Midwest of America. He politely declined my invitation. The next law firm I entered was a premier law firm in Liverpool, which could trace its roots to the height of Liverpool's status as the second city to the British Empire. Some of the partners still wore bowler hats to the office, and trust me, if you could learn to litigate in Liverpool, you could litigate anywhere. The senior partner was cut from the same granite as Tiger Mike, and on my first day, we had the usual induction, and then the door forced open, and the senior partner strode in and barked at half a dozen wet behind the ears trainee solicitors three requirements. One, don't wear white socks to the office. Two, keep your hands off the secretaries. Three, remember that this is a profession to be proud of and maintain your integrity at all times, no matter what. He then turned on his heel and walked out. Now, what I remember about the senior partner is that he boasted that the firm had the first fax machine in Liverpool. Heady times. He described the telephone as an instrument of torture, and the new photocopier was the size of a small car. And it was great serving my training contract in Liverpool. I remember that I'd not long finished at an interlocutory application in the city courts when I was going home, and I heard about the son of the city, that is Sir Ken Dodd, being acquitted. And you may recall that Sir Ken Dodd was prosecuted in Liverpool for declining to pay sufficient income tax. An optimistic prosecution, if I may say so. I'd not long finished my mundane interlocutory application when I heard the excitement of the acquittal, and Sir Ken Dodd's barrister, George Carman, had summed up before the jury with this now infamous phrase. He left the jury with these words. Some accountants are comedians, but comedians are never accountants. And that's the power of words. Every book ever written, from Shakespeare to Dickens, is simply the rehashing of 26 individual letters. And as lawyers, we must always remember this. The medium for the legal message from BHJ might become more digital, and our innovations are here to stay. But the reality is, the power of our words must stay true. They must stay true to the 200-year heritage of this firm and the integrity insisted upon by the senior partner in Liverpool, who was, if I recall correctly, aghast at the suggestion of the firm having corporate-branded umbrellas. I mentioned earlier that my letter writing today has been interrupted, and I have no sage legal advice to offer the caller other than words of solace. In stark contrast to the humour of Ken Dodd, an old client, a highly respected coach operator, rang me to say that that day had ended badly, as he had been declared personally bankrupt. His gleaming fleet of new coaches had been repossessed, and his house would be next. In February, just gone, he had a full order book, and COVID has taken away everything, and all through no fault of his own. Whilst I could not find the words at the time, I have found some now to share with you and any recipient of this letter who is also suffering from the economic reality of this cruel pandemic. In America, in 1910, President Roosevelt gave a speech, and in it he said, "It is not a critic who counts, not the one who points out how the strong man stumbled or how the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred with sweat and dust and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again. Because there is no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who, if he wins, knows the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails whilst daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those whose cold and timid souls know neither victory nor defeat. The second time I encountered the senior partner during my trainee contract was 2 years after the first, as my contract came to a close. I had adhered to the three requirements of the senior partner, and he rewarded me by saying, "Ian, I have no idea how we would manage without you, but we're going to give it a go." And with that, I was out. But a splash of disappointment is good for a young man, because it teaches him that life is earnest and to be taken seriously. So I moved cities from Liverpool to Manchester, and I met a certain James Backhouse, but that's another backstory. It was he who told me what email was, and I said it would never catch on. Now, the theme of Kipling's poem revolves around the coming of age of his son, and it lists different virtues that would help his child to become a man. And the gentleman who has today declared bankruptcy has a son. I first met him 10 years ago when he was just a boy, and today he is a man looking out for his father. And I'm hoping that he can take heart from Kipling's "if," which reads later on in the poem, "Or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn out tools." Later on it says, "If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on." I'm hoping that this client can hold on. On day one of a law degree, we're taught about the importance of precedence. And to be honest, I never want to hear the word unprecedented again. Now, this letter is a homage to Alistair Cook and his letter from America, but is also my respect for everything that Radio 4 churns out. I'm an addict for everything on Radio 4, apart from The Archers. And perhaps you would indulge me by letting me finish by comparing the lockdown webinars to the shipping forecast, which is broadcast daily on Radio 4 between midnight and 1 a.m. And for me, the shipping forecast is like an umbilical cord drawing us home. It defines us as an island nation, and I like to listen to it from the warmth of my bed. A lot of the names are unfamiliar to me. I have no idea where Finisterre actually is, but it extends my horizons, and it makes me think of slightly peculiar worldly places inhabited by communities that we're connected to but we know nothing about. It gives me a respect for those on the high seas in the dead of the night. The shipping forecast, hopefully, like the BHA webinar, binds us together when so much divides us. The BBC voices inspire calmness and certitude. They conjure up the British countryside, a friendly pub with warm beer, Lancashire hot pot, hot chocolate, flapjacks, a Labrador curled up on a rug. It's part of this fabric of being British, like red telephone boxes or the chimes of Big Ben, the smell of cut grass, scones and jam, and yes, Wimbledon and its reference to triumph and disaster. For me, the shipping forecast is hypnotic, but listening to it, you can't help but feel that everything will be all right. I hope you can take strength from our webinars, that eventually and hopefully everything will be all right. Thank you for listening, and God willing, I'll be back next week.